Mark, which is the earliest gospel, scholars tell us, which was written, and upon which Luke and Matthew key their own gospels, because there is much less teaching in Mark than there is in the Gospel of John or Matthew and Luke. It is easier for us to spot the peregrinations and movements of Jesus throughout Galilee and finally down into Judah and the Jerusalem area. And it's also easier to spot Jesus' kind of non-stop healing activity. That healing really becomes important in the Gospel of Mark for a number of reasons. To show that when the Messiah came, it was thought that he would heal people of all uncleanness, particularly leprosy and forms of being crippled and withered arms, and that even Jesus would raise the dead, which Jesus does with Jairus' daughter, among others. What we're dealing with today is almost the midpoint, actually the midpoint of the Gospel of Mark. And what we have celebrated as a church community is the season of Epiphany, which starts with the Magi seeing the star in the sky. And so we have the idea in Epiphany that God is light, and in God there is no darkness, and that we are called to follow the light. And it ends, Epiphany ends, actually, last Sunday, and this is the season now, one Sunday, of the Transfiguration, and then this Wednesday, we move into the season of Lent, which culminates into Jesus' crucifixion on Holy Week, and then the resurrection as well. So what we're dealing with is kind of, and I want you to understand the kind of an up-and-down nature that we see. We will see, first of all, that Peter confesses Jesus to be the Christ. And that occurs in a place called Caesarea Philippi, which is north of Galilee. So it's the furthest most point that Jesus travels geographically to the north. Peter will confess this, and then a moment later, when Jesus starts to talk about the fact that as Christ, he has come to suffer and die for people, there will be three death knells in the Gospel of Mark. What I'm about to read is number 1, 931, 32 is number 2, and the final death knell in 10, 31 to 35, where Jesus will proclaim the same message that he has come, not to heal everybody necessarily, although that's a mark of his messiahship, but he has come to die so that he might be a ransom, as Jesus says in 10:45, for all of this. So I want us to focus on Peter's getting it right 1 minute and getting it right another minute. I want us to focus on the fact that Jesus is talking about his crucifixion 1 minute, and then he takes them up to a mountain and is transfigured before them, and they see Moses and Elijah. Just to say a word about that, Moses was considered the great lawgiver. And Jesus then becomes the new lawgiver. As we know that Jesus sharpens the law in many ways. He does more with the law than Moses does. And Elijah is the great prophet. Moses lived 1,400 years before Jesus. Elijah lives in the 8th century, 800 years before Jesus. And he is the prophet par excellence. And in fact, he does many of the things that Jesus does. He will raise someone from the dead. He performs a number of miracles. And Elijah is unique in the Hebrew scripture because he is taken up in a chariot of fire. He doesn't die. And so the belief in Jesus' day was that Elijah was coming again because he never died. John the Baptist fulfills that role, but if you have been to a Seder with some of your Jewish friends, there's always a seat there that's vacant, right? And that's because there is always that expectation that Elijah might walk through the door and sit and celebrate the Passover with that Jewish family. So, with that introduction, hear now God's word to us. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, Jesus asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say you're John the Baptist, come back to life again. Others say that you're Elijah. And still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" Jesus asked them. "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered them, "You are the Christ." And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Jesus spoke plainly about this. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," Jesus said. "You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." And then Jesus called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, for whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory." After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up to a high mountain where they were all alone. And there Jesus was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Peter did not know what to say because they were frightened. Then a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my Son whom I love, listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no longer anyone else but Jesus. And as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. And then a little bit further on, when they came to the other disciples, having come off the mountain, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. And as soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. "What are you arguing with them about?" Jesus asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth and gnashes his teeth and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." And Jesus replied, "O unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I want to address the issue of the nature of reality and of life. I want to talk about what you perceive life to be. Is it a line which is going upward and forward? Is it a line which is descending? Is reality composed of peaks and great valley? Or is reality something which is kind of an up and down line like a roller coaster? And I would suggest to you that reality as it is construed in Scripture and as we experience it is like a roller coaster. It goes up and it goes down. And I think we see this in a number of instances in our scripture. First of all, reality is like a roller coaster because in many ways we deal with difficult things in life. Jesus tells the disciples that yes, he's the Messiah, but he's come to die for us. And I think the disciples afraid, as they well should be, that if Jesus is going to die, they're going to be in trouble too, and they may die, reminds us that at times in our lives, we're somewhat aware of our finitude, and at times in our lives, we're worrying about our dying. Suddenly, we're reading all sorts of medical manuals, and we're looking at the obituaries, and we're eating a little more healthily. I was at the farmer's market yesterday, and I've met this guy who was purveying and selling blackcurrant jelly and blackcurrant drinks. And I said, why is blackcurrant good? And he said, well, it has more antioxidants than pomegranate juice or anything else in the whole wide world. Well, I said, give me 5 quarts. I'm taking it. I don't wanna die yet, so I'll take everything you have that's gonna make me healthy. But notice, I think one of the things we deal with periodically on the downside of the roller coaster is we think of our mortality and we think of our finitude. And then when we're on a Mount of Transfiguration and Jesus seems so real to us, we're not thinking of that at all. We're thinking how great life is. And the writer of Ecclesiastes tells us, if we live in the present tense, we're in good shape. And so when everything is going our way and we're on that Mount of Transfiguration, the last thing we're thinking about is dying. But then that moment passes, doesn't it? And we're back to thinking about our mortality. And sometimes we have great confidence in ourselves. Sometimes we think we're world beaters, and we should. We're Jesus' sons and daughters. We have all the confidence in the world like Peter. Peter could say, I know who you are. You are the Christ. You're not anything less than that. And then suddenly our confidence is stolen when Jesus says to Peter, oh yes, but I've come to suffer and die, and that means you're going to carry a cross too. And Peter says, hold on, that's not what I signed up for. And then when Jesus upbraids him, where is his confidence then? There is none. So look at your own lives. Sometimes we're very confident, and other times the next day we're not. And in fact, I think at times we're all rapid cyclers, to use a mental health term. Sometimes we're up in the morning and we think we're world beaters, and by the time 5 o'clock arrives, we're ready for the bad news on the nightly news because we feel the same way and we have no confidence whatsoever. And often life presents itself externally as moments when we're very sad about life because there are things we cannot control. I think the gospel is very difficult for people who must control everything. I think the gospel is very difficult for people who say, I'm in charge of life. I'm in charge. There's nothing I can't control. That is simply illusion. And so sometimes we feel we can control things, which we can. But what about those blocks in our lives where things are out of control and there is nothing we can do to change the situation? So how do we deal with the roller coaster of life when we feel as if we failed Jesus? And then because we can't cure someone, we feel we failed that someone. How do we deal with the roller coasters of life when we're on that Mount of Transfiguration and it's just wonderful and beautiful? Well, there are a few ways that are not good that we try to control the roller coaster of life. In our day and age, we try to medicate ourselves. So instead of the roller coaster, we want a steady state. And in order to achieve that, we may use alcohol or a variety of dry goods, if you know what I mean, to try to self-medicate ourselves into a steady state or a steady high, perhaps. And the problem with that is the high may be high, but when you're not using whatever you're using, the low is really low. And you really crash. But people try to do that. They think often that will help. Well, what are the other things we try to do? We try to self-medicate spiritually and get rid of the highs and lows, the roller coaster, by convincing ourselves that once a special event happens, life will be unproblematic from then on, right? It's an either or, it's a nothing or everything dichotomy. So we say, once I retire, There'll be no problems. There'll be no... I hear some tittering. Well, I think that's good. You're listening, and once I retire, boy, once I get that place down in South Carolina, you know, and it's a little warmer than it is up here, and the taxes are a little lower, everything's going to be fine. And then the hurricane comes, and you watch your dream house kind of float away in the wind, right? Once I get married, oh. Now, don't laugh, those of you who are married. That'll solve all my problems. I will be problem-free once I'm married. Once I find Mr. or Ms. Wright, that's it. No more problems. I'm fine. No more roller coaster at all. It's just going to be steady state right up to heaven. And then the same person may say, once I'm divorced. Oh, I thought Mr. Wright was Mr. Wright, but he's really Mr. Wrong or Ms. Wrong. So I know that once I'm divorced, life is going to be so wonderful. I mean, I'm just going to have so much fun eating Chinese food by myself and watching the depressing nightly news. Yes, my life will be unproblematic once I have children. You know, once I have children, my life is going to be wonderful. Oh, no more problems, no more roller coasters. Children will make it just the way it should be. And that same parent will say, when that child is a surly 15 years of age, I'll be happy and the roller coaster will stop once he or she is out of the home. I can't wait to be an empty nester. Oh, man, that's when I start to live. When he or she, my progeny, who I often hate to even mention, when my progeny is off at the armed services or wherever, that's when I will live. So what we find ourselves doing is trying to negate the roller coaster by making propositions that truly don't work. And in fact, I think, because they run up against the nature of life, they make it worse. So how do we deal then, biblically and positively, with what we all know is the roller coaster of life? And the first thing I'd like to say is I think we have to have an attitude that says, as Jesus says on the cross in Luke 23:46, Jesus states, Lord, into thy hands, Father, I commit my spirit. And this is a phrase which we're going to see during the season of Lent, which is coming up this Wednesday. Lord, into thy hands I commit my spirit. You know, I think in order for us to transcend the roller coaster nature of life, we have to understand that there are things that we cannot fix. There are areas in life which we cannot control. We cannot control our aging. We may not be able to control our dying. There are things we cannot control if we lose a job through no fault of our own. There are things we cannot control if someone says to us, I no longer love you, and that's never going to change. And on a positive note, too, I think there are things which also make us produce agita and anxiety and everything else. We can't control someone who loves us and we don't love. We can't control our own feeling when we hate a job that we can have in perpetuity. So I think we need to admit and we need to say to the Lord, sometimes I can't control things and I have to accept that. And I think in the acceptance, I think that's good news. 2 weeks ago, maybe I should say it was 5 weeks ago, so you won't think I'm contagious. I'm not. But I had that stomach virus. How many of you were subject to that stomach virus? Oh, my. Oh, that was tough. Because it was very tricky. You know, I felt really sick, and then I began to feel better. So I felt sick right after a wedding rehearsal down in Poughkeepsie. And I felt better, and I did the wedding the following day, felt fine, and then I got sick again. And I thought I could control this. I thought, mind over matter, there's a lot to do. And my secretary, Debbie, said, why don't you go to bed? I said, do I look that badly? And she said, well, normally you look badly, but you look even worse than no, she didn't say that, really. But, you know, and I loved it. Because all I did was watch fluffy television shows and slept. And I couldn't do anything else. And it was almost good to realize that the world would go on without me, rather well, by the way, and that there was a situation in my life which I couldn't control, and that I could just leave it in God's hands and say everything will be okay. And it often takes an illness, doesn't it, for us to stop and say, you know, I have to give this to God. I think that I'm in control and I'm not. I need to say, Lord, into thy hands I commit my spirit, whether it's a cross or something, hopefully a lot lesser than that. Into thy hands I commit my spirit. There are some things in life that I can't control, and if we can accept that, then life doesn't seem strange or unfair or unjust or whatever. It's just that we are finite. That's the nature of the reality God has given us. Well, the second thing there was another thing I wanted to say about not being in control. You know, when there was a woman who had written it. She was 26 years old. She had she was a yoga instructor. She ate everything well. She exercised. She did everything for her health, and she got cancer. She got cancer. And she said, I thought I could control everything. I'm a vegan. I don't eat meat. I'm a vegan. You heard the story about the good Muslim guy who went to heaven, and he thought, you know, in Allah's heaven, there'll be 70 virgin, beautiful virgin women attending to me. But he gets to heaven and that's not the case. And he asks Allah, what went wrong? He said, well, you weren't as good as you thought you were, so you get 70 vegans to, to take care of you. Not quite the same. But she said, you know, I thought I could control more than I could by eating right, by exercising, by teaching mindfulness, by doing this, that. I did everything correctly and I'm still ill. She did two things. She started eating steak. She went back to church. She did two things. Well, the second point. Focus on the things you can do. If life is a roller coaster, and if there are some things you can't control, I think it's good to know what you can't control. Don't waste your energy on things that you can't control, but do the things you can control and do it well. That's what, you know, you leave some things to God and then God says, this is what you can do, so do it. So what Peter does, and he has been roundly condemned sermon after sermon, and I've done this, Peter builds three booths. Because we say he wants to stay in that high state on the Mount of Transfiguration. He doesn't want to go down in the valley of the muck and the things that he has to deal with. Let's just stay up there and we'll build three booths. And we think, well, he's being unrealistic here, but at least he's building something. At least he's doing something. And I think that's important for us to do. Because we're not Buddhists. And we're not Hindus. And I know a lot more about Buddhism than I do know about Hinduism, but I think probably what I'm about to say applies more to Hinduism than Buddhism. But when you look at religions of the Far East, there is a certain passivity when it comes to what one can do in reality. In other words, Hindus and Buddhists, I think, and I don't mean to generalize, and I have a great respect for their faith, but it seems to me they look at reality and they say, we just have to accept what we can't change. And we can't really change anything. We can't really change anything. So we have to be stoic and passive and everything else. And that's not Christianity. It was interesting, there was a Christian theologian who condemned Mother Teresa. Because he said, Mother Teresa, who's helping everyone in Calcutta, helping them die with dignity and die with a strength of self-worth and understanding. He said, well, she's not really Christian. Now, he's being a little harsh here, but hear me out. He said that if she were really Christian, she would not simply go along with a caste system which allows people to starve and die, but she would attack the bastions of power. She would attack those people who support that casteism. And that's, he said, what Jesus would do. Well, I think Jesus would do both. But Jesus never is passive when it comes to evil. So there may be things we can't do in our lives, but there are things that we certainly should do. And that distinguishes Christianity, I believe, from Hinduism or Buddhism, that we are more active. Last week I had a wonderful experience, and I didn't think it was going to be wonderful, but it was great. I had to serve as a juror. And I've done this. I haven't ever served as a juror. I've been in jury pools, and I've been disqualified. And they didn't have the good sense to disqualify me again. But it was a felony case that lasted for several days. And what I became aware of, because the judge and everyone else, the commissioner of jurors and the judge who was passionate about what he did, but he reminded us. He said, you know, you may think there's nothing you can do in society. You may always complain about the fact that there's nothing an individual can do in our society. It's just beyond us. But that's not true, he said. To serve on a jury means that your voice is heard and that your voice is very important. And it's amazing to me, one of the greatness of our country, and I know people are knocking our country for this and that, but one of the greatest things we have in our country is the fact that we take such good care of presuming someone is innocent until proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt. I mean, that is sheer gospel. And for me to participate in jury duty, someone said to me, oh, was it tough? I said, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. I have to wait for 6 years. I wish it was 6 months. I'll take someone's place, because we realize that one individual voice or one individual action can make all the difference in the world. And that's you and that's me, can make all the difference in the world. You know, the New Testament, Paul says, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Do the good that you can do. Paul says in Romans, you know, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. We can do that. And 1 John 5 says that if we are born of God, we can conquer the world. Wow. Now that's different than saying we can control everything. What the Bible tells us is there are some things we can control, and we better go about doing that very thing. Final point I'd like to make is that in order to get by the roller coaster of life, always remember those transfiguration moments in your past. Can you do that? Are there times in your past where God felt so close to you, as the Quran said that God is closer than the vein in your neck? Have there been times in your past where your faith just flourished, where things just seemed to open up for you in ways that you realized was beyond what you could do? I have a feeling we've all had those moments. And what our gospel says is that hold on to those moments when life gets really tough. Hold on to those moments when life is really a roller coaster. Hold on to those moments when your faith is dim in the present. Reverend Joshua Billings writes in the 60s about a parishioner he had who was very, very old. This parishioner went through the Great Depression, and he went through it alone because his parents died in 1925 before that Great Depression hit. After the Great Depression, he was shuttled off to an orphanage, and then he had foster parents who really didn't care about him that much. And then he was wounded in the leg so that he walked in a limp because he participated in D-Day, the storming of Normandy, and the end of Hitler's rule. And the minister, the Reverend Billings, asked him, Are you so positive about your life? When all sorts of negative things have happened to you, how are you so positive about your life when your first wife died unexpectedly and your second wife died in a way that lasted longer than it should? How can you be so positive about your life? And he said, well, when I was very young, I was 9 years of age and I got contracted scarlet fever. And no one knew whether I was going to live, and I didn't know whether I was going to live, but I had a vision. I had a vision of a white light, and I saw Jesus, and I saw grandparents I never knew, and I saw a number of hands saying, welcome, welcome, you are loved, you are loved, you are loved. Whenever I get in trouble, whenever I get sad, whenever I get down in life, I look back to that 9-year-old boy and what he experienced, and that gets me through. That's the transfiguration experience. And I think if we don't have something we can look back in the past for, perhaps it's something that's coming up. Perhaps we can be aware so that when that transfiguration experience comes, we can be aware that that's what it is. There was a newly minted minister who visited another elderly man. And the man was very, very sick. And there was a chair by the bed, close to the bed. And the young minister said, I see you've been expecting me. He said, no, that chair is not for you, but you can sit there. He said, throughout my life, for a while, I didn't have faith. I didn't know how to pray. And someone taught me to just put an empty chair next to my bed, and before I go to sleep, talk to the empty chair as if Jesus was sitting there. And the minister said, has that been helpful? He said, very helpful. Yeah, I talked to the empty chair as if Jesus was sitting there. 2 weeks after that conversation with the minister, he died. And the elderly man's daughter called the minister and said, would you do the service, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, maybe you can explain this to me because I can't explain it. So when my dad died, his head was resting on an empty chair next to his bed. What was that about? Well, we know. We know what that was about. Thanks be to God for our victories. Amen. Let's stand and greet one another this morning.